episode 6. Thank you, everybody that's been listening. Our listenership continues to grow, which is awesome, especially it's reaching out to some different areas in the U.S. So thank you for that. Continue to share everything. I appreciate it, the social media following and stuff like that. So today I wanted to talk about the Iroquois Confederacy. I think some of us would remember it, say, from school, right? There's the Iroquois and the Algonquins, and, you know, kind of what they did and what they meant to the start of the New World, as some would call it, or the beginning of the North America colonization from Europeans. So, you know, a major player in the Northeast during the 1600s and into really the 1800s even was the Iroquois Confederacy. And originally the Confederacy was made up of 5 and then ultimately 6 native tribes that they were all, you know, similar culturally but also linguistically, so they could share kind of thoughts and have conversation. But they were also all located in the Northeast of what is now the United States, right? So primarily New York. And specifically in New York, it'd be upstate, the Capital District, the Mohawk Valley, and then Western New York in the Finger Lake region. So reading from east to west, if we were to look at the tribes, how they kind of were lined up, all the way to the east, you had the Mohawks, and then you had the Oneidas, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, and the Senecas, all of which, with the exception of Mohawk, are now counties, right? Oneida County, Onondaga, Cayuga, and Seneca. And, you know, although the Mohawk tribe still exists, I think we primarily kind of know the Oneidas because the Oneida Indian Nation has a casino. The Cayugas, they have their casinos in their kind of territory as well. And then you have the Senecas as well, that kind of Western New York, Buffalo, Niagara Falls, that way. How they got their name, it's kind of unknown, but it's believed to have been given to them by the Algonquins. And then as the French interpreted the name, they added some things to it. Could potentially have been a derogatory term that Algonquins used against the Iroquois. And then the French, not knowing that, they would normally use whatever term that they had heard from a different tribe to, you know, kind of refer to, label, and track other tribes too. So the Iroquois, though, themselves called them, and I'm going to probably butcher this, but the Haudenosaunee, that's not that bad, or people of the Longhouse. So I don't know if people remember in the history books, the Iroquois actually lived in hardened structures, and they were long, you know, wooden framed buildings with bark and other things on the outside of them. You know, these buildings could hold an entire family unit, so anywhere from like 30 to 50 people. Not the teepee that people often think about, you know, when they think of native tribes and things like that. So the name kind of too is symbolic. There was like this vision, not that it was ever going to actually materialize, but the name was kind of symbolic to the thought of this like 300-mile-long house, and that the five tribes were ultimately one long extended family over the course of 300 miles. So if you think about like geographically how far that was, I mean, if you go from Buffalo to Albany, it's a hike, and that's kind of what their tribe extended to, and even a little further past Albany. So it was also thought that the Iroquois must have migrated to this area at some point, well before the 1600s, but the surrounding native Algonquins, which surrounded them on the north and the south of them, shared like very little similarities to them culturally and linguistically. So it was kind of believed that the Iroquois must have migrated from somewhere early on, well before the 1600s, but they also had a lot of similarities with Cherokees, which are located in the southeast of the U.S. The Cherokee tribe right now is in like western North Carolina and kind of like Tennessee, the Appalachian little circle up there. They could have come from there or vice versa. You know, the Cherokees maybe could have branched off, but they did have some similarities in there. There was a sixth tribe that ultimately joined the Confederacy, which not the Confederacy in the South, but the Iroquois Confederacy. And that was kind of later on. It was after the 1600s, and it was the Tuscarora tribe, which actually migrated from the south. They had fought kind of against the colonization of the south, and they had gotten beat up pretty good during one of their conflicts, and ultimately moved up to the northeast. But primarily, what we'll look at is the original five and what it had to do with everything up here. Huge players in the French and Indian War pre the Revolution, huge players during the Revolution, and we saw them kind of trickle out of importance during the post-Revolution and into the Civil War and stuff. But we saw them reemerge in the 90s, a little bit before the 90s, in the 1900s, with some of the territory disputes and things like that, which now, we have sovereign nations inside the United States that fall under some of these tribes. In Iroquois history, there's two kind of main players that I want to talk about. Peacekeeper was one of them, and Hiawatha was the other one. So, to kind of give backstory to them, we could look at the names of the tribes and kind of what it meant to things, right? So the Mohawks, were con there was a name for them. I can't pronounce half of them, but they considered themselves people of Flint Country, meaning their warriors were armed with flint arrows, and they were known to be pretty overpowering. And their enemies called them Mohawk, which is kind of how the term Mohawk came from it, but meant man eaters. They're a pretty vicious tribe when it came to fighting. The Oneidas were the people of the Standing Stone. And that kind of referred to that a large rock would appear and wherever the people moved, and this would kind of give them some direction. The Onondagas were people of the hills because they were in kind of a highland. The Cayugas were land meets the boat, so you have like the Finger Lakes region, right? And then the Senecas were people of the Big Hill, and that's kind of how they described their homeland. So you had, although the Confederacy throughout its existence was supposed to be a brotherhood or alliance, there were some pretty tough times and some conflicts internally, and one of the biggest times was referred to as the Dark Times. I also want to correct myself because I'm pretty sure I just referred to this individual as Peacekeeper. His name is actually Peacemaker. Okay, so during the Dark Times, the Iroquois, it was considered that people forgot to be thankful and that they were straying from their creator's vision. And war broke out in most, if not all, villages. So a constant cycle of revenge war kind of continued to plague the Five Nations. Most of the time in their beginning, a lot of wars were due to revenge, not necessarily fighting outsiders and things like that. The creator decided to send a messenger of peace to be born amongst the people. When I was reading a lot about this, I found so many parallels between like Christianity and kind of their story about things. And I think in every culture, every area in the world, the original story about a creator has so many similarities. So I just wanted to kind of point that out because when we talk about Peacemaker, it's going to sound a lot like some of the other stories or the other things that we read about other cultures. So, Peacemaker's name is considered to be sacred by the Iroquois, so that's why we refer to him as Peacemaker. I don't see his name in a lot of things that I read about him, so we'll just use Peacemaker as the title for this person. So, Peacemaker was born to a virgin mother who had yet to gone through puberty or the ceremony to become pregnant, so basically, similar to the Virgin Mary. Her mother was worried of what the local tribes would say, so she hid her daughter away during the pregnancy. And then once she gave birth, the grandmother and then the mother of the baby tried to kill the baby on three separate occasions so that no one would know of his existence, which is pretty harsh. But after the third attempt, the child would just keep coming back, right? They would try to throw the baby into this river in the cold, and each time the baby would return back to the home. After the third attempt, the mother and grandmother realized that this must be someone special, and they determined to raise this child very carefully. And as he aged, he had this great gift of persuasion and communication with people. So when he was old enough, he set out on his journey to restore peace amongst the five tribes or the five nations. And to add to his kind of image and how he appeared to people, he reportedly had a canoe made of white stone, which it's kind of insane, right? They carved a canoe out of stone, but to the natives, it was crazy because they would see this stone floating and think that this is a magical person because they had never seen a stone float. Whether or not it was really a white stone floating is unknown, but the story and the legend says that he used a white stone canoe. He first started in the Mohawk tribe. Apparently, they needed the most persuasion slash the most training on how to be peaceful amongst each other. They were considered probably the most savage of the group at the time. He spent the most time there. Once he got the Mohawk tribe on board, he then moved on to Onondaga, and we start to see the introduction of two other big names. One was a female by the name of, yeah, I'm gonna butcher it too. It's tough when you don't have someone saying the name for you first, but Chikanseshe, we'll say. But her house was considered a neutral zone for anyone passing through. So regardless of the conflicts that would be happening, this woman's home was considered a neutral place. You would leave your weapons outside, you would come in, and she would feed and clothe and house you for whatever time frame you needed. When he first went through there, he explained to her what his mission was. She broke down in tears, said she'd never, heard anything so beautiful. The great peace, the great laws of peace. She said that forever moving forward, that she would live her life by that, and that she would spread the word for. And at this point, Peacemaker told her that she would be the symbol of leadership of women, which would be considered our clan mothers. And moving forward in kind of Native American history, the clan mothers had some pretty significant roles in within the clan, within the family structure. Somewhere in his journey from the Mohawk tribe to the Onondaga tribe, so not much is said about his interaction with the Oneidas, but somewhere between the Mohawk to the Onondaga tribe, he ran into our next biggest player, Hiawatha. Also, it's spelled as Ionwatha in some of the stuff. But the leader of the Onondaga Nation was apparently a pretty evil man, Tedoharo. So I'm gonna call him Ted, right? So Ted was a pretty evil guy. They almost describe him as being kind of like Medusa, right? He had snakes in his head and a crooked body, and he pretty much symboled every evil person, and he did a lot of evil deeds to kind of give him this image in the history books. Peacemaker tried to explain this great peace to him on multiple occasions, and he didn't have much luck. But where Hiawatha comes in is Tad had killed some of Hiawatha's family. And Hiawatha had kind of exiled himself at one point, and he was also looking to kind of change things. So when Peacemaker met up with Hiawatha, they continued to move across the lands to try to convince everybody about this peace. They worked pretty hard on getting Tad to change his ways. And I mean, on every occasion until the final, they would fail. Finally, there was 49 men that sang the great song of peace. It's called the Hi Hi. And the song kept on one purpose, and that was winning over the mind of Tad. Once they finally convinced Tad, it's written and said that his body straightened and the snakes were combed from his hair. Tad was also supposedly a cannibal who would use skulls to eat his food as bowls. So, just to kind of paint the picture of the type of guy Tad was. But Once Tad finally converted to peace, Peacemaker gave him a special position in the Confederacy, and that was to watch all of the Five Nations fire that burned for them. And he accepted that offer, and for the rest of his life, he made sure that the fire would continue to burn. So now that we have our peace from Peacemaker in Hiawatha, we have this Five Nation tribe that is now set to engage in war, not amongst each other as much, but against those coming to the what is now, northeast of the United States. Just the time frame too about this great peace between Peacemaker and Hiawatha and the nations. It was said to have happened at some time between 1350 and 1600. So, the first white explorers didn't arrive into this area until the early 1600s. So, once they had actually settled in this area and had run into the Iroquois, they found that there was a relatively settled, peaceful agricultural society. They had gotten past their conflict in dark times. In the beginning, the Iroquois had bow and arrows and wooden armor, and when they first kind of ran into the French had firearms and metal body armor. This kind of changed the military tactics of the Iroquois into the stealth, surprise, and ambush stuff that we think of when we see movies like Last of the Mohicans or anywhere you have natives engaging with Europeans. So kind of that guerrilla warfare stuff, they began to change into that in order to be able to kind of have an advantage over these better equipped soldiers coming from other places. In the past, like I said, they fought for revenge, and now they fought kind of for economic purposes, like control of beaver grounds or maybe raiding beaver pelts from Europeans or something so that they could trade for to the Europeans for goods and other things like that. Through the 16 and 1700s, the Five Nations remained kind of always on the same side until the American Revolution in the mid 1700s, and that was where the Confederacy pretty much ended at that point. The Oneidas fought with the colonists, right? So they fought for independence, and a majority of the other factions sided with the British, the Mohawk being the main one and the most brutal of them. Because of the kind of what was happening at the time, the Council of the Confederacy decided it was up to the individual groups to fight for who they wanted to fight for. And, post-war, the League was pretty damaged, like politically, as far as being aligned with each other. But then also, I mean, tons of them were killed throughout the war. So after the war, you did see a lot of American raids that destroyed some of those Iroquois towns that did not side with them, and then ultimately they were kind of pushed from their lands. It's interesting to know that the Oneidas fought for the colonists because I feel like that was the first tribe in New York to like be established, have a casino, and make money. Not necessarily that that's the case, but certainly seems like it. And then when you look kind of to the east, I don't know where the Mohawk Nation is. I don't know of that area or that territory. If I'm driving through, someone to say, "Oh, look here, there's the Mohawk Indian Nation." So history is often written by the victors, and they decided not to write them into history. So towards being the 1800s, the nations, remained pretty fragmented and everything like that. And then there came a development of the new religion, and this kind of helped revitalize their culture, and it transitioned them to reservation life, because as you had settlement and influence from the new American government, these kind of reservations began to develop where it was like, hey, this is our land, this is where we're at, we're going to live together, not amongst you, but with ourselves. And starting kind of in the 1950s, you started to see the land disputes start between New York State, the United States government, and these tribes. A lot of it had to do with the power authority or the Army Corps of Engineers and some other things like that. But at some point, you know, they ultimately were given the sovereign rights of their territories. During those kind of fights with New York and the government or things like that, there was a descendant of one of these tribes. Her name was Harriet Pierce, and she said, "The white man views land for its money value. We Indians have a spiritual tie with the earth, a reverence for it that whites don't share and can hardly understand." And that was from a book called Now That the Buffalo's Gone, a study of today's American Indians by Alfred Knopf in 1982. But to support that kind of claim, the Seneca chief was quoted at one point saying, "Keeper of the Iroquois," that he is the keeper of the Iroquois spiritual fire, kind of that my boy Tad I talked about was supposed to do. And he disputed the assessment when he was told that Indians are poor because they don't necessarily have that wealth that the you know, Americans that live in the areas might have. And he said, "We're rich people without any money, that's all. You say we ought to set up industries and factories, well, we just don't want them. How are you going to grow potatoes and sweet corn on concrete? You call that progress? To me, progress is a dirty word." And that came from an interview with National Geographic in 1987 called The Fire That Never Dies. So, you know, a huge culture in here and a lot of things. At some point, we'll talk about more of the military side of it, of how the Oneidas did for the colonists, and then mostly how that affected the Battle of Oriskany and things like that, and even the Battle of Saratoga. But like I said, thanks for listening. This is a really quick, really dumbed down version of 600 years of Native American stuff in this area. So we'll definitely do more episodes on it. But thank you for listening, and look out for the next one.